From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A disease is in the news.
Tonight, the mysterious disease causing international anxiety.
The Zika virus is spreading rapidly through the Americas, and that's left researchers scrambling.
That experts say is spreading explosively, could infect as many as 4 million people in the Americas in the next year. 4 million.
It seems not so long ago that another foreign pathogen was threatening U.S. shores, prompting media hyperbole and anxiety.
You may have long since stopped worrying about Ebola. Are you ready for Zika?
Probably not, but here are the basics. Zika is a mosquito-borne illness spread primarily by the Aedes aegypti mosquito found across the world, including throughout the southern United States. While the symptoms are relatively mild, the virus has inspired horror because of its observed but not yet confirmed association with microcephaly, babies born with underdeveloped brains, notably in Brazil. Also unproved but observed, ties to Guillain-Barré syndrome, a sudden paralysis. These potential effects prompted the World Health Organization to declare Zika a global health emergency. Countries across Latin America advised women to avoid pregnancy, and President Obama requested $1.8 billion in funds to confront the virus.
But how much should we worry about Zika? How clear are the links between the virus and microcephaly? What can Zika tell us about future outbreaks? We're going to spend the rest of the show wading through the Zika waters. Jonathan Katz was in Haiti last month when he began to show symptoms. He wrote, "Reporting on Zika when you have Zika," for the latest issue of the New York Times Magazine. Jonathan, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks for having me again.
So, you're not a pregnant woman. For you, Zika was not a medical emergency.
No, not at all. Mostly, I just felt run down. It was a little distressing to look in the mirror and see the rash all over my face and chest and stuff. If you compare it to other mosquito-borne diseases like chikungunya, where it becomes so painful that, like, you can't even walk, you can't touch things because, like, your hands hurt so much, it was nothing like that.
Chikungunya, dengue, which I think you've had, right?
Yeah, I had dengue.
Way worse.
Oh, yeah. No, dengue was awful. And if you get it a second time, it can kill you because you can develop dengue hemorrhagic fever. So stay away from dengue. That's really, really bad.
Okay, so there's that. Malaria, Zika, all covered by mosquitoes. You know this very well. How did you get bit?
I don't know. I didn't get the license plate number of the one that got me before it
but
flew
off. But
what
did you do to avoid it?
Well, I was doing everything that I could. I was wearing permethrin-treated clothes, long pants, and generally a long shirt if I was going to go out late in the day. We had a permethrin-treated bed net. Permethrin is basically like a super toxic insect repellent that you use to soak through your clothes and stuff. And you wear serious bug spray when you're in a place like that, you know, like at least 30% DEET, but we also have like 100% DEET that I kind of hate because it just sort of burns.
So it's not an easy problem to fix. The public health minister of Haiti announced in mid-January that there were 6 confirmed cases of Zika. 2 weeks later, the official tally of suspected cases was at 125. You wrote that, unofficially, at least, it's everywhere.
Yeah, it was everywhere. When they were saying there were like 6 confirmed cases, I was like, well, I know all 6 of them, I think. So
we had some coverage of Zika in the U.S., and it sounded a little like this.
Virginia now has 1 confirmed case of a deadly disease spread by mosquitoes.
A dangerous virus spreading. Could it reach Northeast Ohio? We go to the experts.
Massachusetts has its first case of the Zika virus. A Boston man diagnosed.
That did sound really exciting. And if I didn't know what Zika was, and I basically didn't have it at the moment that that was happening, if that was the first that I'd heard of it, I would have been like, this sounds like a horror movie. Now, just to be clear, I think that it's really a good idea to err on the side of caution. But the issue is that, you know, in a lot of those places, for instance, in Boston, the radio comes on and they tell people that there's a guy who's sick with Zika in Boston. Like, that really doesn't matter. Because, first of all, there are never Aedes aegypti mosquitoes in Boston. Second of all, it's the middle of winter. So you're not going to get bit. And even if one person has Zika in the Boston area, the odds of them being able to have it transmitted from them to a mosquito to anybody else are basically nil. So What are you communicating when you report the news like that? What are you actually telling people?
How do you think the average American should react to the information that they're getting, or local or state government?
So this is a really hard problem. It comes in when you're talking about preparedness for disease, but it also comes in when you're talking about earthquakes and hurricanes, you know, just all sorts of things. And oftentimes people will only start paying attention to something when they freak out about it. But then this leads to another problem, which is that not everything that you prepare for is going to happen to you, but you always need to prepare. The way that human nature seems to work is that if you tell people to prepare for something and then it doesn't happen, you do end up with a little bit of this boy that cried wolf syndrome.
Now, in the case of the Zika virus, that mosquito isn't going to find its way to Boston, but it could find its way to Puerto Rico, Texas, Florida. Don't you think they need a little cattle prod of fear, maybe?
There are some common sense things that you can do to try to prevent yourself from getting Zika if you live in an area that is going to be affected. State and local governments or national governments in places like Haiti or the Dominican Republic, they can go on mosquito eradication campaigns. They can make sure that there isn't a bunch of standing water around for the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes to breed in, stuff like that. Scaring people just for its own sake doesn't really accomplish anything. And the more dramatic and the more dire that you make it sound, the worse that sort of boy that cried wolf syndrome is going to get afterward.
Let's talk about the fact that Zika seems to have gotten people talking about mosquito control. 500 million people contract malaria a year. Maybe 2.5 million of them die each year. 22,000 die from dengue each year. But it's taken Zika to get people to focus on mosquito control. Why?
First of all, the idea that this can harm your baby before your baby is born, that gets people's attention. That's every parent's worst nightmare. But I think the biggest thing that's going on is that this is a disease that is in the same hemisphere as the United States, in areas that are close to the United States, and it is happening on the heels of a number of other epidemics that have gotten the attention of people in the United States. And the thing that you have to keep in mind is, yeah, 500 million people are infected with various forms of malaria a year, but the 500 million people tend to be poor and tend to live in countries that don't have a lot of power. If there was rampant malaria in the United States or Western Europe, we would be moving heaven and earth to cure malaria. If you look back at the Ebola epidemic, Americans only started caring once, you know, the first patients with Ebola were being brought to the CDC in Atlanta. And if you remember, there were news helicopters literally chasing the ambulance, live footage of the patient being taken out of the back of the ambulance. And Sanjay Gupta, you know, on the air, very seriously discussing what this all meant in capital letters.
And wild overreaction by several governors.
Oh, yes. And none of it had anything to do with what was actually happening in West Africa. Ebola, and I think Zika as well, sort of entered the American political sphere in terms of how the United States relates to the rest of the world. If you're the sort of person that wants to, I don't know, build a giant wall across the border with Mexico and make Mexico pay for it, then you are going to regard these diseases as another form of foreign invasion. And it provided an opportunity for people like Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, to grandstand and detain a nurse whose crime was having gone over to West Africa to help people who had Ebola, keep her in quarantine, even though there didn't seem to be any actual reason to do so. Frankly, even if there is a strong possibility that a disease that crops up somewhere overseas could spread and get here, one of the important preventative things is to work together internationally to try to address the systemic roots of poverty so that we can prevent those diseases from cropping up anywhere. There are lots and lots of threats. And it's really better to nip them in the bud.
Lots and lots of threats.
Yes.
So what's the message we should, as members of the media, be sending? How do we deal with this?
I think you have to say what you know. You have to say what you don't know. And then also keep in mind the bigger picture. I mean, Zika is a disease that, as far as we know, is new to the Western Hemisphere. But this seems to now be happening every couple of years. Chikungunya did the same thing in 2014 when it showed up. Once it got to the area that the Aedes aegypti mosquito is in, it spread like wildfire and everybody was affected everywhere. As the planet continues to get warmer, the range of this particular mosquito and other mosquitoes is going to expand, and more areas are going to be affected by mosquito-borne diseases than were in the past.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Katz wrote about having Zika while reporting on it for the New York Times Magazine this weekend. He's also the author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. And he's a writer in residence at Duke University.
Meanwhile, in Brazil,
there's a sense that foreign media is much more hysterical than we are. Here in Brazil, there's not much panic.
Patricia Campos Melo is an editor-at-large and columnist at Folha, the largest daily newspaper in Brazil. She says that the Brazilian press and government were slow to catch on to the seriousness of Zika, despite a string of warning signs.
In the beginning, even the Minister of Health, he said of Zika, you know, Zika is very benign, we shouldn't worry about Zika, we should worry about dengue, dengue is much more serious. But then the outbreak happened in March, April, May in the northeastern states. And 6 months later, the babies with microcephaly started to be born. And that's when people finally realized this is serious.
Well, those images are attention getters. In fact, they've been compared to the picture of the child who died on the beach in Turkey, finally putting a human face on the Syrian refugee crisis. Were these images splashed all over the front pages in the television?
Yeah, and that's a huge discussion going on here in the media. Should we or should we not publish those pictures? I spent a week in Pernambuco, the state that is the most affected, and the photographer who was with me, he took several pictures of babies. We got authorization from the parents to publish the pictures, but this is an ongoing discussion. Are we being sensationalist? At the same time, if you think about the picture of the little boy who drowned, the Syrian boy, it's the same thing. I mean, it took a picture to make people start paying attention. So maybe that's what's happening now, because you have the pictures in the front pages every day.
And then on the other hand, with all of the focus on Zika, it tends to distract governments and health organizations from ongoing crises.
There was this virologist who said people are paying so much attention to Zika. We still have like hundreds of deaths of dengue virus in Brazil. In 2014, I covered the Ebola virus, and there was this hysteria here in Brazil that the Ebola virus would come here. So people say, instead of paying attention to that, why don't you pay attention to dengue virus, which is actually happening?
There has been some sense that the burden for Zika and its health implications is being placed on women, as you said, to stay indoors and use bug repellent and not get infected, certainly not to get pregnant. But the women most prone to this disease are the poor, who are crowded into slums in Rio and elsewhere, and in rural villages, they have little access to prevention, much less diagnosis or care, much less abortion, which is illegal. Has Folha or other newspapers or television given voice to the women who are most at risk?
Well, we had some stories in the Northeast and in the very poor parts of it. Some of the women who were pregnant and had babies who had microcephaly, the husbands abandoned them. And this was a very, very sad story, because they were viewed as, you know, you're to blame because you had a child who has a problem. So we did a story on that, and we also did a story on maternity leave. Here in Brazil, you have mandatory four-month maternity leave, and the women who had kids with microcephaly were requesting this to be extended. So I think this is something that speaks directly to the needs of the women who are having to bear the brunt of the whole crisis, right? Abortion is also a huge issue right now.
Well, let me ask you about abortion, reproductive rights. Is this crisis changing the discussion of abortion bans in general?
It is changing. Right now, the only way you can get a legal abortion is if your baby doesn't have a brain, or if there's a risk to the mother, or if she was raped. But basically what happens is that if you're rich, you go to a private clinic and you get an abortion. If you're poor, you don't get an abortion, right? As you said, most of the women who are affected by Zika and having babies with microcephaly, they're very poor mothers and they can't get abortions. So some activists are requesting the Supreme Court include Zika as a probable cause to get a legal abortion. But now the Catholic leadership has already said that they strongly oppose this. And even the Minister of Health said, well, we're going to follow strictly the law and Zika is not one of the factors that allows for legal abortion.
Is there any chance that this question about abortions for women infected by Zika will lead ultimately to a more robust discussion about marginalized women in Brazilian society? I mean, is there potentially a silver lining to this nightmare?
That would be wonderful, although I doubt that would happen. I don't think the country or the politicians are ready to fight for that. The political climate now is really tough. But it's the one chance we have to show that poor women are the ones who are suffering most if they can't access a legal abortion. And the other thing that could be a silver lining is if the government finally realizes that we have to be serious in combating the vector, the mosquitoes, and we need to have more resources to do that. But I'm not that optimistic.
Patricia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patricia Campos Melo is an editor-at-large and columnist at Folha. She spoke to us from Sao Paulo.
Coming up, the line between public health messaging and media panic.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Despite its recent notoriety, Zika's not a new virus that just materialized in the Brazilian jungle and is barreling north. In fact, it was first detected nearly 70 years ago in the Ugandan forest of Zika. It went largely unnoticed in parts of Africa and Asia for decades, likely because its symptoms aren't nearly as serious as those of diseases like dengue and malaria, and because the populations where it circulated had developed immunity. But in 2007, Zika began to register on the global health agenda when it jumped to the Pacific island of Yap and infected most of its people. Nikos Vasilakis, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Texas, says that from there, those mosquitoes covered a lot of ground.
Basically, the virus island hopped to reach French Polynesia, and from there it reached Easter Island, which belongs to Chile, and from there we believe it made it to Brazil during the World Cup. You know, there is a robust traffic between the islands, and daily there are several boat rides. So viremic individuals, when they get on the boat and they go to the next island, there are plenty of mosquitoes that may be feeding on them and become infected. When they take another blood meal, they may transmit the virus to a new individual, and so the cycle continues.
Now, human-to-human transmission. What do we know?
Well, what we do know so far is that the virus is present in the semen, and we do have a few documented cases that the virus has been transmitted by sexual intercourse to another human being. The question mark that we don't know is how long the virus remains in the semen.
What do we know about the link between Zika and microcephaly?
Right. There are several direct and indirect lines of evidence. So, for example, let's start with the indirect line of evidence. We do know that on an average year in Brazil, there are about 140 to 150 microcephaly cases. Now, congruent with the introduction of Zika in the area, there was a 30-fold increase in the cases of microcephaly to about 3,700 That was in 2015. That number has increased upwards in the few months of 2016 to about 43 to 4400. So this is an indirect line of evidence. In terms of direct lines of evidence, we do know the genetic signature of the virus was detected from a handful of fetuses that were aborted or they were delivered stillborn or they died soon thereafter. So we do know that the virus is infecting
the fetuses.
Exactly.
So the one thing you still can't say for sure is whether it's causing microcephaly.
That is correct.
How many pregnant women do you need to follow, and how long do you need to do it before you can make a definitive link?
You would need to do long-term case control studies. Definitely, you need a few thousand pregnant women, and this type of studies, they may take a few years.
Could you put Zika in context with malaria and dengue and chikungunya?
Well, remember, only a very small minority of the symptomatic cases in a very high-risk group, and that is pregnant women, may show the effects of microcephaly. That doesn't mean that any woman that is pregnant and is infected may deliver a baby with microcephaly. What we tend to forget is that about 70 to 80% of individuals infected with the Zika virus, they are completely asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
That means they may carry the virus, but they do not have any symptoms or they don't know about it. Look, the same thing can argue about West Nile or chikungunya. So, for example, when in 1999 West Nile came into the United States, it took about 2 to 3 years to spread throughout. And there were a couple of large epidemics for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then once the immunity was established, then you would see the virus completely disappear, lurk in the background. Once the immunity was reduced again, it started producing epidemics. It basically follows a bell curve. Introduction, rapid expansion, establishment of herd immunity, then gradual decrease in the cases, and then disappearing.
And then reemerging when the immunity is reduced.
Exactly.
Well, I know that you are concerned about sustaining an effort to keep the bugs down. You were talking about an example of an effort to eradicate this very mosquito in the Americas back in the 30s.
The eradication of Aedes aegypti from Latin America back in the 30s was a Herculean task, going house to house, removing containers or breeding grounds from the houses. If there was no compliance by the individuals, then they were getting fined or even going to jail. That lasted for a few years. The mosquito was completely eradicated, but the public servants, once they realized that the mosquito has been eradicated and it was not present for a number of years, they posed the question, well, we don't have it around, why we should still pour money into it? Well, there were a few countries not compliant, and Aedes aegypti was still circulating. It took about 10 to 15 years to recolonize the entire continent.
Recolonize the mosquito.
The mosquito. And with the recolonization of mosquito, dengue reappeared in Latin America and a few other infectious diseases. Now, I may say also that effort in eliminating the mosquito, it also came with a severe price. The agent that was used to eliminate the mosquito was DDT. And of course, we all know the severe ecologic effects that it had in the food chain during that period of time. So it's not as simple as one may think.
You've noted that one of the major problems that may have contributed to the rise of Zika is that there haven't been funds for surveillance, essentially general monitoring. Frustrating that those resources only seem to follow global outcry. I mean, The National Institutes of Health has never funded a grant for Zika research before this month.
Well, it's part of the game. You know, just to paraphrase Tip O'Neill, the old Speaker of the House, saying that all politics are local. Same thing is all research is local. And one of the questions that I got through the years is, why do you think it's worth spending public dollars on this if it's not a problem from the United States? Well, the answer is we have seen it. We have seen it with dengue. We have seen it with chikungunya. We have seen it with West Nile. And now we're seeing it with Zika. Just because a virus may not be now an issue for the citizenry of the United States, that doesn't mean that it will not be a problem in the future.
Now, you were actually in Brazil examining this link between Zika and microcephaly before this recent outburst of coverage. That's how you spent your Christmas. What did you see?
Well, it was really a heartbreaking experience. And what it struck me the most was that as I was observing the parents coming in the hospital, and they had covered the babies completely so they were not visible, as they came to the waiting area and they realized that there were another 40 or 50 people with their babies, that they had the exact same predicament, you would see that they started taking off the covers and they were talking to each other and they were caring for their baby, you know, showing signs of affection and so forth. And you could see that tragedy. I mean, you look at the kids, the babies, and it would break your heart. And then you would see the parents, some of them in complete denial, or some others, you know, showing this unfettered love that it would take even the strongest man not to cry.
Nikos, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nikos Vasilakis is an associate professor in the Department of Pathology and a member of the Center for Biodefense and Emerging Infectious Diseases at the University of Texas Medical Branch.
So Dr. Vasilakis says that the way the game works is that research funding follows emergencies rather than preceding them. The WHO, in declaring the Zika outbreak to be a global health emergency this month, is now opening a spigot on just such funding. It also sounded the media sirens.
The World Health Organization has officially pushed the crisis button on Zika.
The last emergency declaration like this, the Ebola outbreak in 2014, that crisis killed 11,000.
Christian Lindmeyer is spokesperson for the WHO. Christian, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you both. Thanks for having me.
WHO has declared a global health emergency only three times before this. Why Zika and why now?
The very important thing here is the possible connection between microcephaly and Guillain-Barré and Zika. Zika alone was not ground enough to declare a public health emergency. It is this presumed association with those two heavy defects. If there is a link, and it looks like there could be, then scientific efforts need to be really vamped up to determine what the possible link is, what the possible causes and effects are. With this expert opinion by the emergency committee, this committee recommended to call for a public health emergency of international concern.
When Ebola was in the news, WHO was buffeted by criticism that it was acting too slowly in declaring an emergency, and that precious time was lost. Is Zika and your action a political reaction to the criticism from last time around?
Both WHO and the whole world have learned from Ebola, I think. A lot of factors were criticized in the various reports. Transparency, political will, lack of action, and so on and so forth. So all these factors play together in an emergency, and declaring a public health emergency now had, amongst others, also the role to invigorate this political will, to get the budget, to finance the research, to sensitize public health authorities of this new virus and the possible risks associated with it.
If your goal is to call more attention to Zika in order to increase the amount of political will and the potential funding for studying the virus. Well done. That has happened. Zika is omnipresent in the media around the world. There's also something of a panic going on, much as there was a panic going on during the Ebola outbreaks, when the actual risk outside of Africa was minimal, verging on trivial. How do you weigh when the disadvantages of a big media splash outweigh the advantages?
That is a good question. The point here is that there are a lot of unknowns around Zika virus, very much losing the touch with what it is, which is why we need to act fast and get the right information to people in order to assure mothers, assure travelers, and assure, of course, populations living in mosquito-infected areas and advise them what best to do and how to go about.
I want to ask you one more thing about WHO institutionally. You speak English as a second language,
or
since you're Swiss, actually probably your fourth language. But are you familiar with the expression damned if you do and damned if you don't?
Absolutely am, yes.
Is that what you all say to one another whenever a virus gets on the move, that you will be criticized for acting, you will be criticized for waiting, and there's no way to know what's the correct action until long after this stuff is played out?
Well, hindsight, of course, always makes an evaluation easier. But what went into this discussion is mainly the insecurity in people traveling or countries where travelers brought back a single Zika infection. People didn't know what this means. Now we have another virus. People still have Ebola in mind, as you just rightfully mentioned. So the fear in front of any new virus is still huge. So the question wasn't so much damned if you do, damned if you don't. It was more guided by we need to get the right information first together and then find the right means to inform the people and to develop a vaccine or means against this virus.
What do you think journalists should keep in mind when covering Zika or similar viral outbreaks?
To make the difference between the condition of microcephaly, the syndrome of Guillain-Barré, and the Zika virus. Yes, they might well be related, but we need to not forget Zika itself is a mild virus. And if Zika was the only reason to declare a public health emergency, then we should have long time declared a public health emergency on malaria, on dengue, on chikungunya, and so on and so forth. So this is not our real concern. And this I find very important to separate those two to three issues we have here. Yes, there might well be a link, and that link we need to look at. But to make that distinction is highly important.
Christian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Christian Lindmeier is communications officer at the World Health Organization. He spoke with us from Geneva.
Coming up, Zika has launched a debate in Brazil about abortion. A similar outbreak in the U.S. back in the 60s did the same for us.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Sometimes a pathogen is just a pathogen, but often it also creates an opening to talk about underlying problems. When it comes to disasters, very often that problem is climate change. And so it is with Zika. That's because our warming world is contributing to ideal breeding conditions for the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which carries Zika, as well as dengue and chikungunya. David Hassmeyer, a staff writer for Inside Climate News, reported this week on how climate change has been expanding the mosquito's range.
We found numerous scientific studies, numerous public health officials, scientists, as well as anecdotally a couple of vector control agencies in the United States. And in fact, that's how we introduced our story, through the eyes of a vector control officer in the Central Valley of California. The agency discovered the Aedes aegypti mosquito in 2013. It was puzzling to them because this is a mosquito whose habitat is more closely related to very warm and humid climates. And the agency kept coming back to the idea of the temperatures in the Central Valley have been steadily warming and there has been a sustained drought. Those are two of the factors that lead to the establishment of a habitat for these particular mosquitoes.
I associate mosquitoes with standing water. Why would drought correlate with mosquito-borne disease?
The Aegypti mosquito, they're called small container mosquitoes. In some of the regions where this mosquito is now very prevalent, don't have the infrastructure to provide water. People store rainwater to store whatever precious water they can, oftentimes in open containers and in barrels. Those are the types of environments where this mosquito thrives.
And it's not just the Zika virus that's showing up in unexpected places. What other infections have you been able to correlate with warming temperatures?
Lyme disease and West Nile virus. Those two have been very closely studied and tracked in parallel with warming climates. And those are often used as cautionary tales, if you will, as to why climate change has to be taken seriously.
One of the frustrations, I think, that some people have had with explaining the danger of climate change is not what the political right claims, which is that there is a global hoax and conspiracy of academics, but on the contrary, that academics are very, very slow to make the sort of definitive connections that the public can relate to. For example, tornadoes and other severe weather have very much been on the rise, which seem to correlate with climate change. By the same token, something like the Zika virus would seem to be a great opportunity for the climate community to say this issue really has great stakes for the human race. But again, all of the correlations are made with a lot of disclaimers. Can we say that climate change contributes to the Zika outbreak, full stop?
What I think science and health people can say with certainty is that climate change has to be considered one of the key elements. That's what's so important when media reports on this sort of thing. You know, for so long, the media has treated climate change and global warming kind of as if there was a debate. And there's no longer a debate. So when these sort of issues come up, they have to be reported against the backdrop of climate change certainty.
Do you have panic envy? Do you wish the climate protection community would get some sort of borrowed interest from Zika and other possible expressions of global climate change in order to, okay, not panic the public, but educate them as to the stakes here?
Well, certainly. And I mean, you know, for example, if Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy didn't get the public's attention, then nothing will. You know, those severe weather events can be traced to climate change. The issue of Zika has to be taken as an opportunity to educate the public that climate change doesn't have to be Superstorm Sandy. You know, it can be this tiny mosquito whose habitat is growing larger and encroaching, you know, in their own backyards, if you will, because the climate is warming. We don't want to cause panic. Cause that panic too often, people may start to tune you out, saying, well, there they are. They're just saying the sky is falling again. Whether it be economically, through health issues, heat waves, climate change is going to impact people of the world. We have that responsibility to explain how the world and how lives will change if immediate steps aren't taken to address the issue.
All right, David, thank you very much.
Bob, it's been my pleasure.
David Hassmeier is a staff writer for Inside Climate News.
Another issue wedged open by Zika, as we heard earlier, is reproductive rights. This month, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights urged governments in Zika-affected countries to repeal their abortion bans. But this wouldn't be the first time an epidemic has influenced the abortion debate. Leslie Regan is professor of history, medicine, gender, women's studies, and law at the University of Illinois, and she said it happened in the U.S. 50 years ago. But it didn't happen right away. First, we had to learn the real threat posed by the omnipresent, seemingly harmless illness known as rubella, or German measles.
In 1941, it was an Australian physician with mothers who figured out that it caused cataracts, and then they kept investigating and saw heart defects, deafness, and a series of other physical defects, and what they called mental retardation, intellectual impairment. And the babies could have all of these. So women who were educated, you know, and paid attention to health would try to avoid getting German measles or make sure they'd had it. Then there was an epidemic in 1958, but really no publicity about it.
The publicity happened in the 1960s when there was another epidemic. Why in the 60s and not in the 50s?
The difference is the thalidomide tragedy that many people may still remember with Sherry Finkbein and the babies who were born without arms and legs because of thalidomide in pills and cough syrups, and it was mostly in Germany and England. Pictures of those babies were in newspapers, on television, and they were really presented as freaks, basket cases. People were terrified.
You mentioned Sherry Finkbein. Who was she?
So Sherry Finkbein had taken some pills of her husband's, and then she had seen this material in the newspaper with the, quote, deformed babies, and was very concerned. She had gone to a doctor. Her doctor felt she should have a therapeutic abortion, which was legal for certain cases. The doctor was ready to perform it. She and her husband wanted an abortion. And then she went to the press to warn other women. And once she did that, the press started investigating, found out who she was, which hospital it was. And that prompted questions, controversy, religious debate, and the hospital and the doctors losing their nerve and refusing to do the abortion.
And so her right to an abortion for taking thalidomide was the opening in which the whole argument over abortion in the cases of rubella opened up.
And this is the middle of the baby boom. Every potentially pregnant woman in the country can see they could be in this situation. And in their mind, the picture they have is not a rubella baby because there are no pictures. It is those thalidomide babies. And that is what opens up the discussion and changes the representations of abortion in the media. And it was in the media quite a bit. The messages were the result of abortion is certain death. That's one. Other messages by the 50s, there's a Saturday Evening Post article on abortion that talks about the women who have abortions as sick, the kind of women who have bad relationships with their fathers, white women who choose to have relationships with, quote, colored men. They're sexually deviant.
Getting back to Finkbein, who was educated and somebody that majority white America could identify with, do we know how the public felt about her?
Well, Gallup did polls on it, and over 50% of the public supported her and believed that she should have access to abortion. And then there is a big story that appears in Life magazine in 1965, and the cover has a woman getting a blood test. And that headline, The Agony of Mothers About Their Unborn, is over a huge two-page spread of two women in a hospital in bed waiting for their abortions to be performed by, quote, conscientious doctors. This shows safe, legal abortions by doctors in hospitals. They don't use the names of the doctors. They don't say where it is. But there is one woman in this story. It's Mrs. Stonebreaker, who gives her name. They report her to be Roman Catholic. She got German measles from her son. They warn women to stay away from children.
That was the public health message around rubella, stay away from children?
Yeah, avoid children. just as insulting as the current advice that's being given to women today.
The advice given to women in the Zika-affected areas.
Yes. It's just that the federal government then could not possibly have given advice like use birth control and don't get pregnant.
It's interesting. In your book, you discuss an installment of the Ladies' Home Journal, Tell Me Doctor column, which suggests that an abortion is a decision that belongs to the pregnant woman.
In that story, she is both given information that it's up to her to make the decision, and she is in consultation with her husband and her doctor. Her doctor gives her information that says, it's only a 10% chance. And the doctor says, it's 90% likelihood the baby will be fine. And with those odds, I'm not willing to do an abortion, but someone else might. So this is not really her choice.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very mixed message, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is at the same time educating everybody as to what German measles is and that they, in fact, might pressure doctors around this issue. People were able to start talking about it publicly where they had been unable to do so for the last 70 years while it was illegal. And there are physicians who organize the leadership of the obstetrics and gynecology to sign on that they believe that the laws should change. This is only 65, and by 67, 68, you have the medical profession agreeing that there should be a repeal of the laws. It's pretty amazing.
Which brings us back to Zika, because you have the UN High Commissioner, and I'm going to quote him. He says, the advice of some governments to women to delay getting pregnant ignores the reality that many women and girls simply cannot exercise control over whether or when or under what circumstances they become pregnant, especially in an environment where sexual violence is so common. He says that bans on abortion breach human rights treaties. And of course, in most of the Zika-affected countries, abortion is either illegal or mostly illegal. In describing the history of the discussion here, you pointed to the big change that occurred when the emphasis moved from poor people and people of color to, you know, middle-class white model moms. The people who are currently susceptible to the Zika virus are south of the border. And I just wonder whether that's going to suppress the discussion in this country.
Well, I think so far it's sort of seen as they have no reproductive rights in those Catholic countries. But we do here in the U.S. It's not being said, but I think you can read it that way. Well, we don't really have reproductive rights for everybody in this country. This was part of what led to Roe versus Wade, is it varied depending on where you lived, what state, what county, which hospital you went to, and by your income and by your race. And that's why Roe versus Wade was decided in the way that it was. It's because of the inequality. In some places, it is the same as it was. We now have people doing their own. We have some people in hospitals, and people can spend a lot of money to go to another state to get a safe abortion.
I have to say that the impact of a rubella outbreak in the early 1960s came as a complete shock to me.
And you would not have imagined, in a time when nobody was talking about abortion, when it was extremely stigmatized, and women are in pearls and little tiny hats, they're the ones who begin to talk about the need for abortion, and it leads to Roe versus Wade. Similarly, in Central America, South America, there's over 1 million abortions every year, just as there were in the U.S., and they're illegal, and it's stigmatized. We don't know what'll happen, and I'm very, very curious to see.
Leslie, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Leslie Regan is professor at the University of Illinois and author of Dangerous Pregnancies, Mothers, Disabilities, and Abortion in Modern America.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mythili Rao. We had more help from Dasha Lizitsina and David Conrad, and we bid a fond farewell to our intern, Alex Friedman.
Jason!
Inside Joke. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Means and Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.